This session we're going to look at kind of the title of the destruction of gender and sex. We started out, we saw the creation of gender and sex, that God created us male and female, and we've seen what the basis, the foundation of that is. And then we looked at what does it truly mean to be masculine and feminine according to the Bible, and seeing the examples of Proverbs 31, and it's been titled An Excellent Wife, that section. We've looked at the life of Christ to see an example of a true masculinity. And so we've seen that from the creation, God made us sexual creatures. And sometimes to even say the word sex, and especially in church or polite company, can be kind of taboo. But the idea that we are sexual creatures, it includes all of us. The idea that we are created male and female, it's not just our biology, it's in all of our body, and it's even in our personalities, and our souls and spirits have that inclination, those tendencies. Women tend to be feminine, men tend to be masculine, and for our whole creation is part of that sexuality. And so we've seen that the whole idea that you can change your sexuality is just wrong. And so we've been looking at the idea of, you know, how can we teach our sons and our daughters, our young people in our church, our members, to be true men and women, to be godly men and women as they were created. And one of the things that we want to look at today is God's directions for sexuality. And why does God give us laws? Yes. Why does Scripture give us directions and things to do and not to do? Okay, keeps you from going off the road.
Actually, in your message yesterday, right at the end of Deuteronomy 10, 13, I think it says it's for your good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Ten Commandments, especially when you get to the end of them, thou shalt not steal, commit adultery, covet. Why does God tell us not to do those things?
To be more focused to Him and not our desires.
Okay. But
because Galatians also tells us that if you sow to the flesh, then you will be dead.
Okay. But in some ways, the Bible is like the owner's manual. And whenever you buy something, a car or a computer or a toaster, you get a little manual that tells you how to use that. And if you take your telephone and use it as a hammer, it will work. You can hammer a nail in with your telephone. But is that good for the telephone? No. I've seen advertisements that they can put a special protection on the screen and hammer nails. I don't want to try it. But, they give you an instruction manual to tell you how to use it. And if you try to use it in a different fashion, if you try to heat water in a toaster it won't work. Yeah, come on. You know, and if you pour water into a toaster, it will probably shock you instead of putting a piece of bread in, because that's not what it's made for. And so they give you an owner's manual to tell you how, this is how you use this this tool or this utensil. And in essence, the Bible is the owner's manual for humanity. And God gives us these laws and these directions because that's how human beings work. He says, and especially as we're looking at this idea of sexuality, God says, don't commit adultery. Why? Why not? Why not commit adultery? Why would God tell us something like that? Okay. Okay, but it can be pleasurable, so why not? Why not do it?
So God's law is designed like plainly in plain words, like so that we are not harming ourselves, others, and making more positive from one.
Everything's okay. You got everything you need.
Yeah.
God gave us these laws so that we are not harming ourselves, not harming others, and also not hurting our relationship with Him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one reason why they might exist.
Yeah, it's like, why would the owner's manual tell you not to pour water in a toaster? It's hot in there, and if you pour water in it, the water will touch the heating elements and it will get hot. So why would the owner's manual tell you not to pour water in a toaster? Yeah, it will break it. It will, if you try it sometime, you'll see sparks flying and steam, and then probably the whole electrical system in your house will go down and poof, because it's bad for it. And God didn't give us, you know, God didn't say, don't steal and don't covet and don't commit adultery and all of the Ten Commandments and the rest of the commandments and the scriptures, because He's trying to keep us from some hidden pleasure. It's because if you do that, it hurts the human. You hurt yourself. It corrodes it, and you know, you can sometimes, you know, children, they'll ask questions, and you know, your child might sometime as they're growing up ask you, is sex good? You know, and it's like, how do you answer? You know, it's like asking, is gasoline good? Is gasoline good? You know, it's good inside of a car engine, but if I bring gasoline in here to clean the floor, you know, it might explode and kill us all. So gasoline is good in certain contexts, but it can be dangerous in others. And so we see that aspect that, you know, that sex is good, it's wonderful, it's great, and you know, in a relationship with a husband and a wife, there's no shame, there's no guilt. Genesis 2:24, it says, you know, for this reason, because a man and a woman were made for each other, for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother. And we have this idea of leave. And so a man is to leave his father and mother. He starts a new family, and he it says, and he shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And I think in the King James Version, it uses the word cleave, to be joined together. And so there's the, you leave your parents' family, and now you're starting a new family, and with your wife, and you cleave together. And it says, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. There's no shame in marital sex, but joy and pleasure. And God says that sex is only good between a husband and wife. And he says, if you try to use sex in any other way, it's like pouring water into a toaster. It's going to hurt the toaster. If you use sex in any other way, it begins to hurt the person. And so we have this, sex is kind of a mysterious thing. And if you're married, you know the joy and the pleasure it can bring. But sexual experience outside of marriage can bring guilt and pain and shame and consequences. At PTS, we'll be looking at 1 John. And John says, little children, don't sin. And you're like, okay, but why not sin? And he says, if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And it's kind of like, okay, if I'm a criminal and I have a lawyer and a solicitor who can get me out of any crime, I'm guilty, but he can talk to the judge and he can get me out of any crime. Why not continue to commit crimes? If Jesus Christ has paid for all my sins, then why stop sinning? If I enjoy sinning, why not continue? Well, because of the consequences. It breaks me. It hurts my person. And if a young man commits adultery, has sexual relationships with a girl and she gets pregnant, they can ask for forgiveness, but the girl's still pregnant. It doesn't automatically disappear. Or if you kill someone, you can ask for forgiveness, but that person doesn't come back to life. There are always consequences. And the consequence of sex is even on our own person. And we see that the Bible, in one of the passages in Leviticus 18, it tells of the sexual interactions that God has forbidden. He says, sex is to be between a man and a woman. It's not to be with a close relative, not within the nuclear family, a parent, a sister, or a brother, not with the husband or wife of another person, not with multiple partners. And the list continues through Leviticus chapter 20, and it includes the various punishments. And so God is trying to spell out, okay, this is how you use this machine. And sex is good between your husband and your wife, but if you try to use it in another way, it's going to harm this machine, this thing that God, this creature that God has created. And so from the beginning, God has designed sexual purity for mankind from the beginning. And so it's not to imprison us inside a kind of prison and to... Hello? Yeah. The laws of God aren't designed to prevent us from pleasure, but to protect us from things that harm us, that have the capacity to corrode our lives. And I don't know, like in your cleaning, if you ever use acid, and if you try to put acid in a Coke can, in an aluminum can, it starts corroding it. And you might could put acid in an aluminum can one time and use it to carry something, but you try it two or three times, the inside is going to be all corroded. And that's the same illustration that God is giving us, and he's like, these laws are to prevent you from harming yourself. You know, if when you have children, you tell them, don't touch the stove, don't touch the cooker. Because why? You know, is touching the cooker, is that a pleasant experience that you want to keep your child from doing? No, it's to keep them from harming themselves. And so that, you know, the prohibitions that God has given us aren't just simple things that God dreamed up and said, you know, don't do this, don't do that. It's because they destroy us. We read in Jude verse 7, it says that just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing punishment of eternal fire. And then Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 18, Paul is writing to the church, and if you look at the church in Corinth, it was, you would not want to be a member in that church. You know, it was, you know, like having church in a Hindu temple, and you're kind of like, you know, calling, going to a Hindu temple and calling that church. There was sexual immorality. There was, they hated the poor people. They were abusive. They would have the Lord's table, and back then they would have these meals that they would eat together. And so the rich people would come and bring all of their good food and eat it first. And then, you know, they would say, okay, we're going to have a meal, a fellowship meal at 2 o'clock. So everyone come, bring your food, and we're going to share together. And then the rich people would say, we're going to start at noon, but we want all those poor people to come at 2 o'clock. So come early and bring your good stuff. And so then the rich people come and they eat well, and then the poor people arrive and there's nothing left. And so there was no sharing, there was no love. And Paul writes, and he's talking to this church, and he's telling them, don't be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor greedy, drunkards, revilers, swindlers, will inherit the kingdom of God. And some of you used to be these kind of people. And so we see that God, it's not because of the sexual immorality that God punishes them and they'll be sent to hell, but their sexual immorality demonstrates the level of unbelief that they had descended to. And so sin eventually, and in a society that rejects God, ultimately that society falls further and further into sexual immorality. When you look at different cults and you know, we have, you know, weird religious groups that, you know, some guru starts a commune and so forth, and, you know, someone says he's the Messiah, and people come and they live together. Every single time that, you know, might start out as a good group, but it degenerates and descends into sexual perversion because they're not following Christ. It's a cult. But also we see that in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, some of you used to be these kind of people. And so we see the grace of God in this situation. And as we talked the first day, the whole issue of homosexuality and sexual perversion, we don't want to be afraid of that. We don't want to be afraid of those people, because God's grace is able to save them. And some of the people in the church at Corinth had come out of that. One of the reasons why Paul emphasizes in Scripture the dangers of sexual immorality are found in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 15. And he says, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become one flesh. And flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body." And so the sexual immorality is not the worst sin that there is, but it's different. It has a different effect on us. If I steal something, that's wrong. And you know, one sin is enough to condemn you to hell. But Paul is saying that sexual immorality is different because it affects the person. There's a connection. And sex is built into our physical nature. It's an integral part of who we are. It touches our innermost person, and it creates a connection. Having sexual relationships with your wife, it creates and strengthens those connections. But with another person, it still creates connections. And so Paul is talking about that, like a person who commits sex with a prostitute, he's creating a connection with her. And it's kind of like, you know, creating a short circuit in an electrical circuit, and eventually it will burn out. It will burn up the circuit. And so sexual promiscuity, multiple sex partners, it acts to corrode and destroy a person. Well, we're going to look and run through Romans chapter 1, because this shows us this idea of, it shows us where this idea of the LGBTQIA++, they add a new letter all the time. But where does this come from? I mean, are people insane? Are they just being foolish? What? And so in Romans chapter 1, Paul writes, and he shows how sin corrupts a society. And this is especially directed to show the church that was in Rome what was going on around them. And we know from history that the Roman culture began. It was a very strong culture, very strong empire, but little by little it got corroded and fell into sexual immorality. And Paul begins in verse 18, and he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." So it's God's wrath is against all sin, against all unrighteousness. And he says the reason is that the people, not that they don't know the truth, but even the truth that they have, they suppress it. The word actually kind of means to strangle, you know, to take someone and to strangle them so that they cannot breathe and eventually die. They have strangled the truth. And he says, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So as man looks at nature and the creation, he sees that there is order in creation, and that there is an intelligent design, and that should push him, as we've talked about the fear of the Lord, it should push him to seek God. But rather than do that, he strangles that truth, hides it, crushes it. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And you know this better than people in other parts of the world. You don't have to go very far to find an idol created in the image of an animal, don't you? I think you can walk down on here to Shogun Road, and about 200 meters down, there's a temple. And they've got an idol. I can't remember if it's Ganesh or what it is, but it's something in the image of some kind of animal. And Paul says that it's not because they discovered some hidden wisdom, it's because they became foolish. And then, so they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling man and animals and birds. And so what happens? In verse 24, Paul says, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they had exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the Creator, worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. And because of this, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged the natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And so we have the idea of lesbians, men, women with women. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And so we see that the end result of exchanging and refusing to acknowledge God, it results in sexual immorality. And so this whole idea of LGBTQ has resulted from the world rejecting God. And eventually it all winds up in sexual immorality. And it starts with suppressing the truth, denying God, denying being a creation of God, refusing to fear God. And it says their thinking becomes futile, foolish, and illogical. And that's what we see in today's world. We have this idea that if I imagine that I'm a woman, then I'm a woman. And you're kind of like, okay, that's not logical. There's something wrong in your thinking. And if I'm a woman and I imagine that I'm a man, I'm a man. And it's like, I was playing yesterday with the children, and there's like five or six little children, and I was doing a magic trick. And take a coin, and you can say, okay, blow, harder. Okay, one more time. Wait. Oh, there it is. And so I was doing little magic tricks, And he's like, how did that happen? And I said, we're going to make one of the children disappear. And so I said, okay, you know, told the little girl, okay, go over there by the fence. And then I told all the rest, and I said, we're going to pretend that she disappears. So I'm gonna say the magic word, and we're all going to pretend that we can't see her. And so the girl comes back, and I'm kind of like, okay, one, two, three, disappear. And then all the kids around her were like, where did she go? Where did she go? I can't see her. And we're like, whoa, what happened? And she's like, I'm right here. We're like, I hear something, but I can't see her. And the kids are looking all around and said, okay, we need to get her back. Okay, one, two, three, come back. Oh, there you are. And it's the same idea that, you know, I mean, we could see her, but we just pretended not to. And it's the same idea with the transgender movement, that I pretend that I'm a woman. And so now everyone has to pretend with me that I'm a woman. And so you have to say, you know, call me she and her. And now my name is Roberta. And you have to call me a woman. And I'm going to act like a woman. And even though I look like a man, you're not seeing me correctly. I'm a woman. You can't tell that? And you're like, I can't tell that you're a woman, because the reality is you're a man. You didn't change. There's nothing has changed. And we say, that's illogical. Something is wrong with your thinking. But for them, they're saying, I have discovered a hidden wisdom that you don't understand. You know, I am a woman trapped inside a man's body. And, you know, and then the whole idea of cutting up my body so that it fits the image of a woman. And we see that it's foolish and illogical, but Paul tells us that's the slippery slope of sin. And we see that they begin to worship themselves rather than God, and it leads to all manner of sexual and perverse behavior. And so we see that homosexuality, it breaks the person. They are broken. Their way of thinking, their identity as a person has been broken, and it causes harm to them. And we see that, and this is a kind of judgment of God, and there's two kinds of judgment of God. You know, when I was a child, if I did something wrong, my parents would, you know, give me a swat on my behind. And it's like, you know, don't do that again. And so there's a kind of a punishment, a positive punishment from God. We see that like in Sodom and Gomorrah. God burned the city to the ground. We see different times, you know, where God actively punishes people. But here Paul is talking about a passive judgment. God doesn't do anything. You know, God says basically, if that's what you want to do, then I'm going to remove any restraint. I'm going to remove laws that would prevent, you know, homosexuality, and I'll let you go. You know, you're lost, and I'm not going to give you any directions of how to find the right way. And we see that, you know, left to themselves, they go down the path and get worse and worse and worse. And, you know, how many of you have ever seen the hijras? The men who dress like women and go up into the intersections and try to get money. And you look at that and you're like, that is bizarre. It's gross. You know, if one of them, you know, you're walking down the street and one of them comes up and, oh, hi, hi, and comes up and tries to give you a kiss, you know, then you're probably going to go, I'm going to be physically violent now. But you're just like, it's disgusting. You're like, no, you know, stay away from me. And, you know, we see that people are saying, no, that's good. I'm free now to be who I want to be. And we're looking at that and saying, no, that's wrong. You know, you're broken. You know, there's numerous scriptures throughout the Bible that show us, that demonstrate that God prohibits homosexuality. And even though we've been living, you know, we've been seeing it in our cultures for so long, you know, it's no longer an issue anymore. You know, for a sports star or a movie star to come out and say, you know, I just want everyone to know that I'm homosexual. And it's in some ways it even increases their popularity. And we see a lot of young people now that it's become a trend, a fad. And so a lot of young people are saying, oh, there's a number of pop stars that sing, you know, singing, and they're like, I'm trans or I'm a bisexual. And it's kind of like, oh, that's cool. I like this singer, and so I'm bisexual now too, you know. And, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, even adolescents and teenagers that aren't sexually active, they will say that they're bisexual or homosexual just because the music idol that they have has said that's what they are, and they want to be just like that person. Well, I think we'll wrap it up in just a bit, and tomorrow we're going to go into some more. In Romans 1 and 1 Corinthians 6 and Philippians 2, we understand that this isn't something new. The primitive church lived in the midst of this. And in Corinth, there was a chapel, temple up on the top of a hill, a temple, I think, to Aphrodite, who was a Greek goddess, kind of the Greek goddess of love. And there were, you know, several hundred prostitutes that lived in this temple. And every evening they would come down into the city, and the way that you worshipped Aphrodite was you had sex with one of the prostitutes from her temple. And that was considered an act of worship. And so the church in Corinth lived in this kind of an atmosphere. And we know the Roman Empire became very perverse. Nero, it seems, was either homosexual or bisexual or pansexual, just, you know, all kind of wicked things. And so the early church lived in the midst of this. You know, the things that we're seeing, they also saw. So the New Testament is trying to show them, how do you live in the midst of a perverse culture? How do you live in the midst of a pagan world? And one of the things that Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, he says, he's writing them so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain, nor toil in vain. And so we see that Paul is calling for the church, you know, for the, and when Paul's talking to the church, he's not, you know, sometimes we have this idea that the church is this organization that we go to on Sunday, but the church is each family. You know, when we're at work or in our families traveling around, we are the church. And Paul is calling on us, and he's saying, you know, you need to live as lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And the one thing that we want to do is we want to train up our children, our youth, our churches, you know, to be an example to the world. You know, because a lot of the transgender and even the hijra and all of that, a lot of them come from families that are broken. A lot of them come from their children of prostitutes. I was talking to Chris Williams last night, and he was telling us that they used to have, and his wife was kind of directing it, they had an outreach to the children of prostitutes in Pune. And they would go to the house where the madam, the lady that owned the house of prostitution, and they would go there and they would take all of the kids, and they would take the kids and they would have kids clubs, and they would teach them Bible stories, and they would do crafts and things like that. And Chris is saying, you know, he said he was with, I think, an American pastor, and he was riding on his scooter, and he comes into the red light district of Pune, where all of the prostitutes are. And this American pastor was very strict, and as he was seeing all of this, he was shocked. And Chris pulls up to the door, and there's this lady, the owner of the house, right there at the entrance. And she's like, "Hey, Chris, how are you?" And the pastor's like, "You know her?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, she's a good friend of ours. You know, I see her, you know, several times a week." And the pastor's like, "What are you doing here? Why? How do you know this prostitute and all the other women that are inside the house?" And Chris is like, "She's my friend. And we come here several times a week, and we gather all of their children, because sometimes the prostitutes, then, you know, sex is designed for procreation. And sometimes no matter what you do, a woman still can get pregnant." And so he says, we get all of the children, and then we take them over to our church, and we have a kids club with them. And so all of the prostitutes know us, and they know what we're doing. And sometimes they'll even ask us, you know, "Oh, pastor, pray for me. And, you know, and I want to give my child a better, you know, a better home than I can provide. And you know, can you give me some advice? And will you pray for me?" And so Chris was like, "Yeah, sure, we pray for you all the time." You know, and you know, the prostitutes were happy that someone would take care of their children. And so a lot of these, you know, the women and these hijra, they come from families, you know, they're the children of prostitutes. And they don't, they've never had a father. They've only known this kind of atmosphere. And so Paul is saying, you know, when they see a family that works, you know, a husband and a wife that love each other, when they see children that, you know, are respectful and polite and love their parents, and this, he goes, you're a lighthouse shining, you know, you're showing them the gospel. This is what the gospel produces. It produces great families. It produces people whose lives have been transformed. And so that's why we want to learn, you know, what is the biblical basis for humans? You know, what is a biblical woman and a biblically feminine woman and a biblically masculine man? You know, it's so that, you know, our families are strong. They can resist the temptations in the world, but they also are a witness to those that are in those kind of situations. You know, and as Paul has said to the church at Corinth, some of you came from that background. You know, and you can imagine, you know, if a hijra or, you know, a homosexual comes to your church, you know, what do you do? You know, how can you minister to them? And, you know, it's not that we're afraid of them. It's not that we're afraid they're going to contaminate our church. You know, we don't want them to teach that philosophy. But if they come searching for God and seeing a need in their lives, then, you know, we are willing to counsel and share the gospel with them. Well, I think that's going to end right there. Just wanted in this time to look at Romans chapter 1 and to see the progression. I don't know if anyone has any questions or comments to add. I think tomorrow, we're going to look at, you know, in our churches, what can we do to strengthen this idea of biblical masculinity and femininity? What are some things that we can do and to strengthen and to protect our churches and our youth? Some practical things. Some also ideas of what can we do in our families to protect them as well. And so tomorrow will be kind of, I think tomorrow is the last day that we have. Yeah. And so we'll be looking at some practical applications of these truths and, wrapping that up. Well, that's the part I stopped halfway through. The rest of it about what we don't understand about LGBT. Let me just cover that real quickly. We just kind of talked about it. Where it says what we don't understand about the LGBT movement. You know, we a lot of times we talk about that movement, the homosexual movement, as a group that's trying to destroy the traditional ideas of family, to destroy, you know, corrupt the morals of our children, and there is that aspect of it. And especially with a lot of the organizations that try to, you know, change what's taught in schools. But the individual people in it, you know, like it says here, they're trying to make a sense out of their life. They're trying to work through, you know, their people that are, you know, have been sexually abused. I mean, it's my family was a great family. My father never, he disciplined us, but he was never, he never beat us. He was never abusive. My mother and father, loved one another. We had good relationships. And so it's hard for me to understand, someone whose father was a drunkard and was abusive, or to understand, a young girl who was abused sexually by members of her family. And so some of these people have been through situations that were horrific. And some of them, they grew up in a family without a father or without a mother, all kind of situations. And so a lot of them are just trying to make sense out of their life. And, some of them are, it's kind of like, I tried to be on the football team, but I wasn't any good, and all the boys laughed at me. And so I went over and I started, learning how to, design flowers and arrangements, with some of the girls. And they liked me, and so maybe I am, more feminine. But it's just people trying to make sense out of their life and their life experiences. And they're confused. They're often oppressed by the world. They're rejected by people. Some are rejected by their families. They're trying to survive. They're not a separate species. But we need to remember what is the basic fundamental truth about humans. Where does it all start? What is the basic foundational truth about humans? Okay, they're made in the image of God. All of them, the Hijra are made in the image of God. The Pakistanis are made in the image of God. The Nepalese, the Brits, the blacks in Africa, we're all made in the image of God. And Christ came to save sinners. He didn't come to save the righteous, which there aren't any. And, so these people that are going through these things, a lot of them aren't, vile sinners. A lot of them are young children, and as they're trying to make sense of their lives, and people are trying to, push them. And like we talked about the other day, of young children, of the age of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, they like to be with, boys like to be with boys and girls like to be with girls. And, they, at that point, they're kind of like, ew, I don't like girls, and ooh, I don't like boys. And we see that, there are groups that come in and say, oh, you don't like boys? Well, you must be a lesbian. And they're trying to attack them at an early age. And so some of these people that are being convinced, these young people that are being convinced that they're homosexual, we want to be able to minister to them, to share the truth with them. It's their biggest sin is not the homosexuality. The biggest sin is unbelief. That's the root sin. And a lot of times we focus on the sexual sin and forget that, we are all unbelievers. And so a lot of it is, to be able to spend time, have contacts with them. Don't be afraid to enter into contacts and with people of that tendency of, you know, homosexuals and so forth. And then this one thing that we said, you know, what do we do if a homosexual wants to attend our church? And we talked about this, but I don't know if you remember. You know, someone wants to visit your church and he says, you know, I just want to let you know, Pastor, I'm a homosexual. So what are you going to say?
They're coming to know the truth and they are welcome.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. We want to be wise. We want to be loving. And, you know, it's, you know, let me ask you a question. You know, are you truly seeking the truth and want to know God and how he can give you a new life, how you can be born again and have an abundant life? Then, you know, hey, you know, every Sunday we're here. We have Bible studies. We have home Bible studies. We have people who will love you and help you. And but, you know, if you're trying to influence or convert other people, you know, the Bible calls them wolves. You know, they're trying to come in and influence your people. But we'll look at these other parts, and there's some other applications for us, and we'll look at that tomorrow. And so that... It's been a long day, and you know, we're just shoving things. I mean, it's like the food we've have, you know, we have so much food, and you know, we keep eating and eating and eating. It's like I'm so full, I can't eat anymore, and so we don't want you to get, you know, overstuffed, and in the afternoon it gets more difficult to concentrate, so we'll continue tomorrow. So have a good afternoon, get some rest, and we have a great session coming this evening, and so get some rest and be prepared for that as well. I think tonight it's Chris Williams is giving the message, so that'll be really good. In here, in the big room, or what?
Here.
Yeah, I know.
I was slowly stopping to become a nice look.
Yeah, it might be blowing closer on you.
Oh, you could change because I feel hot on someone. What did you say?
You feel hot?
Yeah, you were sitting close.
You sit here, you get that fun, you can see the key, you get there.
You got the AC there?
Yeah,
I should move for a warmer climate.
Have a good afternoon.
Ksan.
Ksan.
Yeah.
Good to meet you. Are you a student here or?
No.
Okay.
He's just coming for this seminar.
Ah, do you live in Goa?
No, we are from Ceylon.
Ah, okay. I'm glad to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Are you enjoying the conference?
Yeah, very much. Enjoy.
Yeah, I'm looking forward tonight to hearing from Chris Williams. He's a very good teacher.
Yeah, he came last 2 months.
Okay.
Ceylon.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's a good teacher, has a lot of experience.
Yeah. So we enjoy with him 1 week.
Yeah. We'll get some rest and be ready for tonight. Thank you for coming. Is there, sit here.
Can I bring tea for you?
Probably not tonight. Usually after 3 o'clock I don't like to have tea. Keeps me awake at night.
This is our class.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can turn it off.